Welcome to Supernatural Stocks on MoneyWeb with your host, The Finance Ghost. This is your weekly fix of equity analysis designed for stock pickers. Whether local or international, you can expect a mix of news and my ideas about what I'm seeing in the markets. Tariffs, wars, geopolitical upheaval, all of this focus on AI. Against this backdrop, my position in JP Morgan is up 24% year to date, and Goldman Sachs, that's up 31% over that period. The NASDAQ 100, 18% year-to-date. That means that my Wall Street fighters have both outperformed the tech-heavy market index. That's another great year for my banking positions in the US. The big banks in the US tend to release their results in the same week, so every 3 months we have a situation where the headlines are flooded with banking news. The theme is clear. Beats estimates, tops estimates, raises targets. These all come through very strongly if you just skim the headlines. Things are ticking over very nicely in US banking. Why the combination of JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs in my portfolio? Well, in the case of the former, I have a position in arguably the best bank in the world, run by the most influential banker in the world. In the latter, I have the capital markets specialists, which means I effectively have an additional dose of investment banking exposure in my portfolio. Both companies released results in the past week, so that's a great opportunity to dig through the transcripts and see what we can learn. We begin with JP Morgan. Jamie Dimon is to banking what Warren Buffett is to investing. He is the most respected voice on Wall Street, so it would just be rude not to start with JP Morgan. But here's the funny thing. Dimon is playing less of a role these days on the calls. CFO Jeremy Barnum led the prepared remarks and he handled most of the questions, with Dimon getting involved only to answer the more policy-focused stuff. For example, Dimon added his voice to the debate around supply constraints in US housing, opining that regulatory hurdles are making it more expensive these days to get a mortgage and a house than it should be. His view is that if the requirements for building permits and getting a mortgage were lighter, then the cost of a mortgage could come down by 30 to 40 basis points without additional risk in the system. In other words, he's saying, make it easier and we can make it cheaper as a bank. Fascinating. Dimon also has much to say, as usual, about the current suite of banking rules, with his complaints being that the rules for capital calculations feel like a handover of the global financial crisis rather than a function of the risks that banks are actually facing on the ground. I guess he just wouldn't be a banking exec if he wasn't advocating for a loosening of the regulatory noose around his neck. Moving on to the numbers, JP Morgan's revenue increased by around 9% year-on-year. Expenses were up 8%, so there is some margin expansion here. This is a very important part of the story at the bank because JP Morgan has a huge retail and commercial banking business in addition to their fancy investment banking stuff that gets me excited. They can therefore rely on technology to make money, not just people to make money. And this is one of the reasons why return on tangible common equity, probably the single most important ratio for a bank, is so high at 20%. Remember, that return on equity is grounded in dollars and the US risk environment, so it's not directly comparable to the return on equity that our local banks make due to the risk differential between the US and South Africa. An easy way to see this is to just look at the relative bond yields. With the South African 10-year bond currently at around 9.15% and the US trading at roughly 4%, that's a difference of more than 500 basis points. In other words, JP Morgan's performance is roughly equivalent to a South African bank achieving a return on equity of around 25%. Only Capitec manages to run above that level. Sure, it's not quite that simple, as there are different rules for capital risk weightings, and you would also need to adjust the banks for the extent of their common equity tier 1 buffers to make it a more accurate comparison. But here's the thing, because of the extent of capital on US bank balance sheets, if anything, making those adjustments would probably tilt the equation even more in favor of those Wall Street names. You hopefully get the idea. The US banks are the closest that any of us will get to owning our own money machine. Now, if we look deeper at how JP Morgan made their money this quarter, the traditional banking business is doing well, revenue up 9% this year. In the juicier stuff that is less dependable over time, that's the theory at least, because it does seem to almost always do well, investment banking fees were up 16% year on year. In the markets business, fixed income was up 21%, equities 33%. Not a huge surprise when you consider the broader market backdrop. As the cherry on top, their asset and wealth management business grew revenue by 12%. JP Morgan is reluctant to do share buybacks at the current share price, which shows capital maturity, but I mean, that's the least we can expect when this is the team involved. So JP Morgan plans to invest the excess capital back into the US economy through lending across their entire business. This is the American way of thinking, with immense belief in their economy and seemingly endless bullishness. And generally speaking, that's why their banks do well. It's also how we got to the global financial crisis, so the regulations are important too. Onwards to the geared exposure, Goldman Sachs, and I'll explain what I mean by that shortly. Goldman Sachs CEO David Solomon, also known as DJ D-Sol, had to scale back on his music side gig in 2023 when there was increased media scrutiny on the performance of Goldman Sachs and the distraction of his love of music. In reality, it was actually more due to macroeconomic factors than anything else, as higher interest rates started to absorb the liquidity in the market and made it a little bit harder for a business like Goldman Sachs to do well. I guess if you want to earn a gazillion dollars a year in the top job, you have to make some sacrifices when the media is looking for a scapegoat. Music is now certainly playing at the investment banking business though, with the group leading the M&A market, having advised on transactions worth more than $1 trillion year to date. These relationships with big corporates tend to go hand in hand with equity underwriting opportunities, with that revenue source up 21% year on year. Debt underwriting revenues up 30%, and in the rest of their markets business, the fixed income, currencies and commodities or FIC desks grew 17%. The TLDR is that when markets are volatile, Goldman Sachs is making money, and when they go up, the asset management business is also making money, with those fees up 12%. This is exactly why I refer to it as geared exposure, as the Goldman Sachs share price will typically move by a higher rate than the underlying markets, both up or down, that is. Unlike JP Morgan and its large traditional banking business, Goldman Sachs almost exclusively involves itself in areas where human capital is the most important capital, and those humans get paid plenty of money to give up their DJ careers and almost any semblance of a personal life, which means that the usual focus at Goldman's is on the compensation ratio net of provisions, or, in simple terms, what they pay to staff as a percentage of profits. In other words, investors want to make sure that they are also getting a fair slice here, and that all the money is not just being made for the insiders. Unlike at JP Morgan, where the increase in role of the CFO on earnings calls is leading to transcripts that are somewhat more bland, the Goldman Sachs transcript offers us some excellent insights into the state of play in US banking and the strategic thinking. I'll therefore end off with a few direct quotes from David Solomon. Here's one that gives us a sense of corporate optimism in the US. He said on the call, "For corporates, it's clear from our conversations in boardrooms that after a period of heightened uncertainty and volatility early in the year, many of our clients have navigated and adapted to the current state of play. Though near-term policy considerations are still relevant, many CEOs have shifted their focus back to long-term and strategic decision-making, particularly amid a more supportive regulatory environment." That sounds pretty bullish to me. And now for one on the general state of the markets, and specifically the AI bubble that everyone is talking about. Taking a step back, there is no question that there is a fair amount of investor exuberance at the moment, with US equity markets consistently hitting record highs over the last several months. Much of this has been fueled by a tremendous amount of investment in AI infrastructure, which has driven significant capital formation. But as students of history, we know that following periods of broad-based excitement around new technologies, there will ultimately be a divergence where some ventures thrive and others falter. While I feel good about the forward outlook on balance, the market operates in cycles and disciplined risk management is imperative. Very, very useful commentary there from Solomon about where we are right now in the technology cycle. Now, speaking of risk management, he delivered a great nugget on risk and how important it is to avoid the really big losses. It's amazing how similar this is to the approach that many fund managers take in their equity portfolios. In response to analysts trying to dig to see if Goldman Sachs has exposure to any of the major corporate failures currently in the press in the US, he said, "Part of the key to credit underwriting is to make sure that you miss some of the more challenged credits." Challenged credits indeed. I guess that's one way to describe a bad debt. And finally, on the topic of growth in alternative assets as another major theme in the market, Goldman Sachs added a record $33 billion in alternative assets in this quarter. They expect the full year number to be $100 billion of additional assets. For context, of assets under supervision of $3.5 trillion, they have $374 billion in alternative assets, or more than 10% of the total. This includes asset classes like private equity, private credit, real estate, infrastructure, hedge funds, and more. If there's a way to make money in interesting ways in the finance industry, Goldman Sachs likes to be involved. I remain very happy with both my positions here as long-term players. There's no such thing as an opportunity without risk, and these are merely my opinions on the stocks covered herein. Make sure that you do your own research, form your own views on the market when doing anything in your portfolio. Nothing in supernatural stocks should be taken as advice.